Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Continuing our study of the Srimad Bhagavatam, with some special emphasis on these first four chapters of the 10th canto, Krishna's birth and the different prayers by different demigods. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, one who properly understands the nature of Krishna's birth in this world does not, upon leaving this body, take birth again. So we are currently preparing our spiritual bodies in this Bhaktivedanta study of the final cantos of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Oh, now what verse did we get up to? 54? Yep. So, Vasudeva said, O best of the sober, you have nothing to fear from your sister Devaki because of what you have heard from the unseen omen. The cause of death will be her sons. Therefore, I promise that when she gives birth to the sons from whom your fear has arisen, I shall deliver them all unto your hands. So, as we can understand, as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, this is a very liberal proposition offered by Vasudeva to Kamsa. One that would even surprise someone like Kamsa. So, Srila Sukadeva Goswami said, Kamsa agreed to the logical arguments of Vasudeva, and as we said, Vasudeva has reasoned with Kamsa through logic and arguments and instilling a little bit of fear of the reactions and by philosophy, so many different ways to save his wife. And of course, if he loses his wife, there'll be no children anyway. And if he saves his wife, there may be the possibility that he saves his wife and perhaps Krishna or some of the children. So Krishna agreed to the logical arguments of Vasudeva, and having full faith in Vasudeva's words, he refrained from killing his sister. Vasudeva, being pleased with Kamsa, pacified him further and entered his own house. So, you know, basically, Vasudeva pleasing Kamsa, you know, means that he's offered some praise, you know, may your good character be spread throughout the universe, something like that. And here we see that, also in the purport, that the character of a pure devotee like Vasudeva is such that even so great a demon as Kamsa firmly believed in his words and was satisfied. So, you know, we'll look at that as we go along. So Vasudeva, accompanied by King Devaki's daughter, went to his home. So Thank you. Now, in the additional notes, Devaki was referred to as a relative of Kamsa, and another reason which Kamsa got from Vasudeva was that which helped him to refrain from killing his close relation, Devaki, was because if he had killed her, a great fight would have ensued among the other members of the family. So he, you know, gradually Vasudeva brought him to reflect on the consequences, and it would have been a great family feud. A lot of people would have died that Kamsa didn't want to die. So each year thereafter, in due course of time, Devaki, the mother of God and all the demigods, gave birth to a child. She bore 8 sons, one after another, and a daughter named Subhadra. What was the daughter's name? Subhadra. There we go. Just testing. Yeah.
8 children and a daughter.
8 sons and 1 daughter. And later on we're going to look at the fact that actually at the time Krishna was born to Vasudeva, Krishna was also born to Yashoda. So she had twins, Krishna and a daughter.
There was a what there?
A what, yeah. So, now, you know, bear in mind that who is the mother of Balaram? Who's the mother and father of Balaram? Rahini and Vasudeva. That would also make Devaki the mother, isn't it? Because she's married to Vasudeva. So, you know, the children of the co-wife, she's also the mother, properly speaking. So, you know, so here we see, we know there are 8 sons, that's Krishna and Balaram, 6 sons, and the daughter was Subhadra, who, you know, was transferred. And, of course, that was the one that was swapped. But, in essence, because Krishna was also born to Yashoda at the same time. That's the forearm form of Krishna was born to Devaki. So then, when Krishna later we hear how he was taken over, he entered into the form of Krishna that was there with Yashoda, and the baby girl, who is Krishna's sister, was transferred. So Krishna, if Krishna and Subhadra as twins, or then it also makes Devaki the mother in one sense of the daughter, doesn't it? You know, so there's a very loose terminology here because there's a lot more to it than, you know, there are sort of other things in play. So, you know, in one sense she's the mother of the daughter as well, and in another sense she's also the mother of Balaram, because it's, you know, her husband's like that. So, and of course, Balaram did appear in her womb first and then went to Rahini. So it's a lot of, you know, it's complicated, but so it's stated very simply. Yeah. And mother Devaki is described as Sarva Devita. Means that because all the demigods emanate from Krishna, therefore she's the mother, in one sense, of all the demigods as well. Yes.
So both Yashoda Maya and Devaki are...
They can be called Sarva Devita.
But Rohini can't be. Because even from Balaram there's expansion.
Balaram is the source of the expansions from which the demigods come.
Yeah, so then why not even Rohini?
Yes, even Rohini. The only thing is that Rohini and Yashoda, see, because Vasudeva and Devaki are in the mood of the Mother of God, if she's referred to as the, therefore the mother of all the demigods that appear from God, but Yashoda and Rohini, although they have the same position, they don't like to refer to their son as God, you know, and the source of all demigods. So, yes, that description is suitable for them, but they, you know, they may be addressed as the mother of Krishna, you know, the mother of Balaram, you know, more so than the mother of the source of all the demigods, you know. It's a different mood, different rasa. Although it is applicable. So and Prabhupada says you know, in the same, in the Krishna book, Prabhupada says the same thing, that Devi gave birth to a child every year, thus she gave birth to 8 male children as well as 1 daughter. And because we also remember that Krishna is the source of all the demigods, including the daughter, who is Yogamaya or Durga. So, Vasudeva was very much disturbed by fear of becoming a liar by breaking his promise. Thus, with great pain, he delivered his firstborn son named Kirtiman into the hands of Kamsa. So every year for 1 year, Vasudeva and Devaki, they're in the palace of Kamsa. So in one sense it's a prison, actually they're in the palace, they're somewhat confined. But it's described that they didn't leave because in the Garga Samhita describes it, Kamsa had the palace surrounded by 10,000 soldiers. So not necessarily the sort of tiny prison we may imagine, but they couldn't escape. But there were, you know, obviously we know that they were shackled and, you know, there were gates, and, but it was still within his palace. There was still some. So it wasn't like the local lockup. Now, here we see that Vasudeva, being disturbed by fear of becoming a liar, breaking his promise, every year, you know, he delivered the first son, Kirtiman, into the hands of Kamsa. So this Namkarana is performed immediately, even though he was going to be delivered into Kamsa's hands, still they do the Namkarana in a simple way. They were all given a name, even though they were immediately killed. So we did a ceremony the other day for a little girl who had passed away, stillborn, and we called her by her name, you know, which is appropriate. So, so we see here, Prabhupada mentions in the Krishna book that, you know, Kamsa was very glad to receive the child, but he became a little compassionate with the behaviour of Vasudeva. So we see this, it is because of Vasudeva's fame for truthfulness that Kamsa accepted his word and didn't kill Devaki. So that maintaining that fame is keeping Devaki alive. And even here, we see throughout the whole course, at different stages, Kamsa does become somewhat compassionate towards Devaki and Vasudeva due to their very saintly qualities, and that kept them alive as well. So, you know, he wasn't doing it just for the sake of fame and honour. We see here that Prabhupada, it's mentioned in the next verse, what is painful for saintly persons who strictly adhere to the truth? How could there not be independence for pure devotees who know the Supreme Lord as the substance? What deeds are forbidden for persons of the lowest character? And what cannot be given up for the sake of Lord Krishna by those who are fully surrendered at his lotus feet? So although the eighth child was destined to kill the Kamsa, Prabhupada mentions that Kamsa considered that any one of them could kill me. And that's why Vasudeva made that promise that I will deliver each child. Prabhupada mentions in the Krishna book, for a great soul like Vasudeva, there is nothing considered to be painful in the course of discharging one's duty. A learned person like Vasudeva carries out his duties without hesitation. On the other hand, a demon like Kamsa never hesitates in committing any abominable action. Therefore, it is said, a saintly person can tolerate all kinds of miserable conditions of life. A learned man can discharge his duties without awaiting favourable circumstances. A heinous person like Kamsa can act in any sinful way, and a devotee can sacrifice everything to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we see that as the nature of Krishna consciousness. Very much evident with the devotees in the earlier days of the movement. You know, if the Srila Prabhupada asked, or you know, even Prabhupada's, the gurus that followed asked that, I want such and such and be done. They didn't consider, oh, we don't have money, we don't have manpower, we don't have facility, we don't have a temple, we don't have a vehicle, they just went out and did it, just somehow or another. I remember when I first joined the movement, after about a week, I travelled on Ramaswamy's bus, and they put me out on the street, a little clipboard, and I was supposed to collect donations, and I was thinking, what do I do? What do I say? What do I sell? I was given hardly any, instructions at all. I basically had to sort of just, yes, we're collecting for ISKCON. And of course, if you said ISKCON in those days, it just sounded like a charity ISKCON. No one knew what ISKCON was. It just sounded like an official name for a charity. We're collecting for ISKCON. You didn't say Hare Krishna, you said ISKCON. If you said Hare Krishna, you get nothing. And, you somehow just, if they stop, you just got to convince them, we're giving out, prasadam, and people come along and they, give up their drugs and so many things. And, oh, yeah, okay, give a little donation. So, very much, that mood. Nowadays, you can, give abundant, temples, there's money, there's manpower. You can ask someone to do something and little something is not quite right. Oh, I can't do my service under these conditions. it's a whole different mood. But, so they want to read this Krishna book. The Nature of Devotees. We follow in the footsteps of people like Vasudev. So, I remember, I started doing the retreats on the farm. I had a meeting with Ramaswamy Maharaj upstairs here in Melbourne. And I said, Ramaswamy, I was managing the farm at that stage. I said, I'd like to start retreats on the farm. He said, you can't do that. I said, why is that, Maharaj? He said, well, you don't have any money, you don't have any men, and you don't have any facility. I said, Maharaj, I'll just start them anyway, and whatever money comes, I will use that to get facility, and I'll get whoever comes to the along to the farm, I'll get them to help me, and I'll just make a start. If I don't start, I'll never start. And he said, all right, Gangeshwar, do it. And that's how I started the retreats. Nothing. And very, very simple. So that was, that was going back. I've told you the story about the trees and the farm. Again, it's, that story. No money, no manpower. And I said to one devotee, you can have this project. You can put those 10,000 trees in. Oh, can't be done, Ganga. There's no money, there's no manpower. And he left. And then a couple of weeks later, he'd come back a month later, and I'd put in the 10,000 trees. And so like that. So in the early days, it was like that. If Krishna's there, the Guru's order's there.
But that was like 98 or something.
Yeah, about that, yeah.
I remember
because
I couldn't help.
Yeah, that's right. See, anyone that come along?
99.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Most of them were kids and a couple of adults.
They did such a lot.
So I remember when we went to pick up the trees, there was just a bunch of kids and myself and one other adult. And because he'd given them for free, but I had to take them out of the punnets because I couldn't afford to put a deposit to keep the punnets, which meant that we had to plant them a lot quicker. These little And he watched us. It was just a bunch of kids from ranging from 7 till about 13, 14, 15. And we just went, you know, a couple of days it took us, put them in boxes. And he came up to me, this guy was a millionaire, he said, he says, I've got kids. I've never seen kids working like that. So what do you do like that? So these bunch of kids, you know, 10,000 plants out of the punters, and then, you know, a few out. What's that?
They were just
having fun. They were having fun. So, you know, you see, so this is the attitude of devotion. Something's got to be done? Okay. Now, make a start. I know. Needs to be done. Not we wait, procrastinate, carry on. And, you know, therefore, I quite often say that sometimes devotees in some of the bigger temples, they can be around for 10 years. It's like 2 years in the old days. You know, the 2 years of quality service they did previously, they were following, you know, really good quality devotional service, you know, and even over 10 years, sometimes they haven't picked up that sort of mood. Still after 10, 20 years, oh, no facility, no. Good training. Now, So Kamsa is understanding. There's nothing, you know, that this Vasudeva is understanding. There's no wicked thing this Kamsa won't do. So I've got to, that's why he's offering his son and doing whatever he can, because he knows that he's got to keep Kamsa, you know, from killing Devaki and what have you. So now, Prabhupada also mentions in the purport, Vasudeva, pure devotee of the Lord, was eager to see Krishna appear as his child from the 8th pregnancy of Devaki. Therefore, he wanted to deliver the children quickly so the 8th turn would come and Krishna would appear. Because these personalities like Devaki and Vasudeva, they're well aware that Krishna is the Supreme Person of Godhead. There are many scriptural references. 59. My dear King Parigat, when Kamsa saw that Vasudeva, being situated in truthfulness, was completely equipoised in giving him the child, he was very happy. Therefore, with a smiling face, he spoke as follows. So, as Prabhupada's mentioned, you know, Kamsa, he's becoming very compassionate and pleased with, and surprised, you know, with Vasudeva's good behaviour. So, you know, Vasudeva's tactics are working with this very wicked person. Otherwise, at any moment, he could do anything. And and Prabhupada mentioned Vasudeva's very steady and equipoised, that he did not seem in the least agitated. Right, because not seeming to be agitated is giving Kamsa assurance. If he's all disturbed, well, maybe the next child he'll, you know, so no, he's fixed up. So for the, you know, for his duty that needs to be done spiritually, it says a self-realized soul is never disturbed by so-called happiness and distress, and this is especially true of an exalted devotee like Vasudeva. So Kamsa says, O Vasudeva, you may take back the child and go home. I have no fear of your first child. It is the 8th child of you and Devaki I am concerned with, because that is a child by whom I am destined to be killed. So you see how much Vasudeva's behaviour actually changed Kamsa's mood. So there's a working relationship. Vasudeva agreed and took his child back home, but because Kamsa had no character of self-control, Vasudeva knew that he could not rely on Kamsa's word. Prabhupada mentions in the Krishna book, one who cannot control his senses cannot be steady in his determination.
Which child was that?
The first child, Kirtiman.
Oh, so he was actually...
And we see there, never put your trust in a diplomat or in a woman. Those who are addicted to unrestricted sense gratification never be truthful, nor can they be trusted with any faith. Right? Now, when, you know, politicians, leaders, members of the royal family, people with uncontrolled senses, even if they appear to have really good quality, as soon as you infringe upon their sense gratification, you'll see their real character. Right? So, for instance, you know, currently people are, you know, they're a little spooked about the coronavirus. So in Australia, you know, although there's no problem with toilet paper, they're going into the shops and clearing it away. Right? Now, so for instance, for my mother, she's 82. She can only go down to the shops when her care worker comes and takes her down there once a week. So that means that these people have no consideration for the elderly. Oh, they can just go without toilet paper. The ill, anyone that's having a little, they don't care. No, I've got my shit. I've got enough for 6 months. And the elderly, and you know, they haven't got enough for this week or tomorrow. So, you know, as soon as the sense grows, oh, you know, this, my sense gratification's at stake, then you see the real qualities come out. But they really don't care about anything except number one, you know, look after number one. In America, some decade or so ago, they had significant petrol shortages for some reason, and people were killing each other. In the, you know, they were lining up, and as they got frustrated and someone, you know, was a bit, they just shot them dead, stabbed them, big fights for petrol. These are people who just, you know, toddle off to work in their, you know, suits and tie each morning, but as soon as it's either you for the petrol or me, you know, I'm not going to miss out. It comes down to a death-like battle over petrol. So, you know, this is... this is the scary thing about this world, that once the shortages hit, water, petrol, foods, I think in most states they're supposed to have about 90-day supply of foods and what have you, but most of them actually have about 60 or less. And so if there was actually a problem, basically within the first week or so, the, you know, people will clear out the stocks. Within a couple of weeks, most people couldn't get some, and some people have got it. And after a month or two, no one's got anything. And then you see the real nature of the people that we inhabit our country with. That's when you see their real qualities will come. They'll come to that day. The inhabitants of Vrindavan, headed by Nanda Maharaj. Let's go. I've jumped the page. Where did I get to? What verse are we up to?
62.
We are up to 62, 63, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did all those.
Just then.
Yeah. The inhabitants of Vrindavan, headed by Nanda Maharaj and including his associate cowherd men and their wives, were none but denizens of the heavenly planets. O Maharaj Parikshit, best of the descendants of Bharat, and so too were the descendants of Vishnu dynasty headed by Vasudeva and Devaki. And the other women of the dynasty of Yadu. The friends, relatives and well-wishers of both Nanda Maharaj and Vasudeva, and even those who externally appeared to be followers of Kamsa, were all demigods. Right. So, now, we've heard previously that the denizens of heaven were asked to take birth in the different families of Yadu and Brindisti and in Vrindavan, and that similarly in the families related to Nanda and the Gopas, so that they could assist the Lord in his pastimes and so that they could enjoy the pastimes of the Lord, witness them, because they also need to be convinced about the supremacy of Krishna. And so we have discussed that previously, that purport in depth. So, yeah, and of course, you know, Kamsa was sort of thinking in these terms, right, that mentioned in the Garga Samhita, depending on how they are counted, any one of Vasudeva's sons can be the eighth one. Any one of them might be the one that will kill you. That is the crookedness of the demigods. So it comes to sort of thinking like that. These demigods are so crooked. They're always against us. They're saying the eighth one. Yeah, which way do you count that, you know? And so that verse there, verse 62, 63, Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core, is saying, they're spoken by Sukadeva Goswami, but they can be taken as the words of Narada to Kamsa. So, Prabhupada explains in the Krishna book, chapter 1, that at that time the great sage Narada came to Kamsa. He was informed of Kamsa's becoming compassionate to Vasudeva and returning his firstborn child. Narada was very eager to accelerate the descent of the Lord Krishna as soon as possible. He therefore informed Kamsa that in Vrindavan, personalities like Nanda Maharaj and all the other cowherd men and their wives, and on the other side Vasudeva, his father Surasena, and all his relatives born in the family of Vrishni of the Yadu dynasty, along with their friends and well-wishers, were actually demigods. Narada warned Kamsa to be careful of them, since Kamsa and his friends and advisors were all demons. Demons are always afraid of the demigods. And as mentioned in the Bhagavatam simile, once the great saint Narada approached Kamsa and informed him how the demoniac persons, who are a great burden on the earth, were going to be killed. Thus Kamsa was placed into great fear and doubt. So, Kamsa wants to precipitate agitate the situation so that Krishna appears as soon as possible. And you can just see the faith of a devotee that when you're dealing with such dangers as Kamsa, his army, you know, the possible death of Vasudeva and Devaki and so many others, in one sense, one may be thinking you bring Krishna, it's just going to agitate the situation and, you know, it's going to have so much problems. But you can see the faith of Narada Muni, you know, now you bring the Supreme Personality of Godhead, everything will be properly adjusted to everyone's satisfaction. And that. Oh, he has, you know, he participates in the pastimes of Krishna with a great broad vision of what Krishna will do and the sequence of events that he'll do. He literally can understand, the future pastimes of Krishna that are coming to do so many things. Akrura was, by the arrangement of, according to his devotional abilities and what was revealed, the confidential nature of Krishna's pastimes revealed to him were different. So the confidential nature of Krishna's pastimes was far more revealed to Narada Muni than Akrura.
So we can't say that actually Akrura was more intimately loving Krishna, more in the Vrindavan mood, and Narada Muni loves Krishna more of Dwaraka mood. All evidence, he knows about Krishna's power, but Akrura, he knows, but then it is covered by his love. Can you say that Akrura is more towards Vrindavan mood?
No, he's more towards... he doesn't understand the Vrindavan mood very well. He's more towards the Dwarka mood.
I'm comparing between...
And Narada Muni...
Between these two devotees, between the levels.
Yeah, he's more mature Dwarka mood. And Narada Muni, he actually understands the Vrindavan mood. And he... also appears as a form of a creeper in Vrindavan so that he can witness and participate and have the dust of the lotus feet of the Brajavasis on his head. So there are different levels. yeah. So, now, this additional notes, we see that in the Madhvacharya Sampradaya, represented by Vijayadvaj Tirtha, this verse is also there. That thereafter Narada, the mental son of Lord Brahma, approached Kamsa and in a very solitary place informed him of the following news. And the understanding of that given by the Acharyas is that Narada descended from the heavenly planets to the forest of Mathura and sent his messenger to Kamsa. When the messenger approached Kamsa and informed him of Narada's arrival, Kamsa, the leader of the Asuras, was very happy and immediately came out of his palace to receive Narada. Kamsa accepted Narada as his guest, offered him respectful obeisances, and gave him a golden seat, brilliant like the sun. So although the demons, you see how, nicely they follow Vedic etiquettes. And you know, as Prabhupada mentions, just because, you know, we say that, sometimes we say, oh, so-and-so, they're doing very Vedic things. Oh, they're worshipping the demigods, very Vedic. But Prabhupada mentions, just by following the Vedas or worshipping the demigods does not take one out of the jurisdiction of being a demon. So it's not indicative that because they're doing so many Vedic things that they're devotees. They can actually be quite demoniac. Anyway, Narada was a friend of the king of heaven, and thus he told Kamsa, the son of Ugrasena, my dear hero, let's see how he flatters. You have satisfied me with a proper reception, therefore I shall tell you something secret and confidential. While I was coming here from Nanda Kanana through the Chaitaratha forest, I saw a great meeting of demigods who followed me to Sumeru Purvata. We travelled through many holy places and finally we saw the holy Ganges. While Lord Brahma was consulting the other demigods at the top of Sumeru Hill, I also was present with my stringed instrument, the Veena. I shall tell you confidently that the meeting was held just to plan to kill the Asuras headed by you. You have a younger sister named Devaki, and it is a fact that her eighth son will kill you. And that reference there is from the Harivamsa Vishnupava. No one can blame Naradaji for encouraging Kamsa to kill the sons of Devaki. The Saint Narada is always a well-wisher for human society, and he wanted the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna to descend to this world as soon as possible so that the society of demigods would be pleased and would see Kamsa and his friends killed by Krishna. Kamsa would also attain salvation from his nefarious activities, and this too would be very much to please the demigods and their followers. And Vishwanath Chakravarti the core remarks, Narada Muni sometimes did things that were beneficial to the demigods and the demons simultaneously. So actually, you know, the net result of this is that Kamsa will be liberated from his nefarious activities. So he will benefit as well, along with many other demons. And Viraragaracharya says that, you know, that the Asuras are always disturbing elements for human society. So, and as Prabhupada mentions in his Krishna book, after being thus informed by Narada about the appearance of the demigods in different families, Kamsa at once became very much alarmed. He understood that since the demigods had already appeared, Lord Vishnu must be coming soon. And very nice purport there. We won't go into it too much now, but I'm sure you'll all enjoy, you know, Krishna's business is to kill the demons and protect the devotees, and, you know, this Hare Krishna movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna coming in the form of this Krishna consciousness movement to annihilate the demoniac principles that are flourishing around the world. And this is done through, you know, spreading the teachings of the Gita, what's that? And the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So, yeah, you get that? Verse 65-66, after departure of the great Saint Narada, comes the thought that all the members of the Yadu dynasty were demigods and that any of the children born from the womb of Devaki might be Vishnu. Fearing his death, Kamsa arrested Vasudeva and Devaki and chained them with iron shackles. Suspecting each of the children to be Vishnu, Kamsa killed them one after another because of the prophecy that Vishnu would kill him. So it appears that up to this point they weren't chained. They were just in the palace surrounded by many thousands of guards. At this point he's contained them a lot more. He's put them in shackles and in prison bars. As Prabhupada mentions, he at once arrested both his brother-in-law Vasudeva and Devaki and put them behind prison bars. So that's the picture that we see. But before this, apparently they were just in the palace, confined. We see that also in the Garga Samhita, it mentions that in his heart he decided to kill all the Yadavas. He then tightly bound Vasudeva and Devaki in chains and smashed Devaki's son against the stone surface. While remembering his previous birth due to his demoniac nature and out of fear of Lord Vishnu, Kamsa killed each son of Devaki as it was born. So Narada had also informed him that in his previous birth he was Kalanemi, who was killed by Vishnu, and now the eighth son is coming, Vishnu, and to kill him. Now, these things are described, mentioned by Jiva Goswami, etc., in the such books as the Harivamsa, etc. Now, in the rest of that purport, it also describes that Narada's intention was that Kamsa, by killing the children, would increase his sinful activity so that Krishna would soon appear to kill him. And of course, Kamsa did. Therefore, Prabhupada mentions in his purports elsewhere that, and we were talking before about how when one's sense gratification becomes impinged, one may, panic and develop all sorts of bad qualities. Prabhupada says that when there's difficulty, an impious person becomes more sinful, and a pious person becomes more pious. So you can predict what they're going to do. And we were talking about the shortages because of the coronavirus. So because there's difficulty, anyone who's impious, they'll act in a very terrible way to anyone else that's around them. Whereas the pious will become more pious and charitable. So Prabhupada mentions in the purport, again, to 65 and 66, that Kamsa attempted to kill all the babies born of Devaki and Vasudeva, although he knew that if Vishnu were born, he would not be killed. Actually, it came to pass that when Vishnu appeared as Krishna, Kamsa could not kill him. Rather, as foretold, it was he who killed Kamsa. So we're going to hear in the additional notes, we discussed last week about the six sons. Who are the six sons? And so I think I read part of this, but there are I've sort of made a summary note because there are some different opinions on some little technical points, but some say Kalanamy was the son of Hiranyakashipu in the Manvantara of the sixth Manu. And Kalanamy fought with the demons alongside Bali Maharaj, and in that battle he was killed when he personally fought with Lord Vishnu in his eight-armed form. He later took birth as Kamsa, and that we'll see in verse 68. And Kalanamy had six sons expert in military affairs called the Sadgarbhas. So, in the 10th canto, chapter 85, there is a, in verses 48 and 49, Vishwanath Chakravarti describes this in his purport, that by the improper act of laughing at Brahma, who tried to enjoy sex with his daughter, they were immediately put in the womb of a demon. They were taken from Hiranyakashipu and then born to Kalanamy's wife. So, now, Vishwanath Chakravarti the core is saying that, you know, the Hiranyak, the Sanskrit means that they're very close to Hiranyakashipu by relationship rather than as direct sons, but they're actually born as the sons of Kalanamy. And Jiva Goswami, in his purport to the Srimad Bhagavatam, he gives a slightly alternate explanation. Being born of Hiranyakashipu means they were born as his sons in another kalpa. He also mentions Kalanamy as the son of Hiranyakashipu. But the Bhagavatam only mentions four sons and not him. The translator has put him as the son of Hiranyakashipu. Other sources say that Kalanamy was the son of Virochan, the son of Prahlad, who was the grandson of Hiranyakashipu. Who is right? Said Jiva Goswami. Yogamaya first made them pass through one more life as children of another great demon, Kalanamy, and then she finally transferred them to the womb of Devaki. So just be aware that, you know, there are Kalanamy was related to Hiranyakashipu as a descendant, and he had six sons. And those six sons of Kalanamy became these Sadgarbhas. So it appears that depending on how they translated that Sanskrit text, some put Kalanamy as the son of Hiranyakashipu, and some put him as, you know, related to Hiranyakashipu through Virochan. That's the son of Prahlad. So that's... Anyway, now Prabhupada's got this in his additional notes, that formerly an Asura named Kalanamy had six sons named Hamsa, Suvikrama, Krata, Damana, Ripumarana and Krurahanta. They were known as the Sadgarbhas or Six Garbhas, and they were all equally powerful and expert in military affairs. These Sadgarbhas gave up the association of Hiranyakashipu, their grandfather, and underwent great austerities to satisfy Lord Brahma, who upon being satisfied agreed to give them whatever benediction they might desire. When asked by Lord Brahma to state what they wanted, the Satgarbhas replied, "Dear Lord Brahma, if you want to give us a benediction, give us the blessing that we will not be killed by any demigod, Maharoga, Yaksha, Gandharvapati, Siddha, Charana, or human being, nor by great sages who are perfect in their penances and austerities." Brahma understood their purpose and their desire and fulfilled their desire. But when Hiranyakashipu came to know these events, he was very angry at his grandsons. "You have given up my association and have gone to worship Lord Brahma," he said, "and therefore I no longer have any affection for you. You have tried to save yourselves from the hands of the demigods, but I curse you in this way. Your father will take birth as Kamsa and kill all of you because you will take birth as the sons of Devaki." Because of this curse, the grandsons of Hiranyakashipu had to take birth from the womb of Devaki and be killed by Kamsa, although he was previously their father. This description is mentioned in the Harivamsa. According to the comments of the Vaishnava Toshani, the son of Devaki, known as Kirtiman, was the third incarnation. In his first incarnation, he was known as Smara and was the son of Marichi. And later he became the son of Kalanemi. So as you can see, apparently there's different curses that they received. One is a result of laughing at Brahma, and one is a result of Hiranyakashipu's curse. Now, in verse 47, now I'm going to read and in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, chapter 85, verse 47, we get this Bhagavatam version that the Supreme Lord said, "During the age of the first Manu, the sage Marichi had six sons by his wife Erna. They were all exalted demigods, but once they laughed at Lord Brahma when they saw him preparing to have sex with his own daughter." Right? So they were horrified by Brahma. Ha! Ha! Like that. That sort of laughing. So they were probably a little bit of disgusting, abhorrence, the laugh of abhorrence. And in verse 48, 49, same chapter, "Because of that improper act, they immediately entered a demoniac form of life and thus they took birth as sons of Hiranyakashipu. The goddess Yogamaya then took them away from Hiranyakashipu and they were born again from Devaki's womb." Now, there when it says sons of Hiranyakashipu, depending on translators translating, that means related to Hiranyakashipu, in other words, grandsons. "The goddess Yogamaya then took them away from Hiranyakashipu and they were born again from Devaki's womb. After this, O king, Kamsa murdered them. Devaki still laments for them, thinking of them as her sons. These same sons of Marichi are now living here with you." So three births they had. From Marichi to Kalanimi to Devaki. Two curses.
It's interesting that like, for example, Chitraketu laughed when Parvati was sitting on the lap of Shiva, in front of all the sages. So here, laughing, I mean, I thought it would be the Lord's and Brahma's acting. He himself couldn't tolerate, so he gave up his skin and took another birth, in that sense. He gave up his body.
It was an abominable act.
Mm.
So what if people will laugh? People will say what? So why is that bigger curse?
People would stop them, wouldn't they?
It's when dealing with superior persons. So, for instance, you know, if the Prime Minister of Australia were to come into the room, although I may agree or may not agree with his policies, it's still not my position to be disrespectful. But there is a process whereby even the Prime Minister is challenged and, rectified if there's any misdealings or removed. It's not my position. For me, it would be disrespectful, but there are people who are, in positions to do that. So similarly, in ISKCON, sometimes there's, very abhorrent behaviour. That behaviour may be brought to the particular authorities who deal with that, and they deal with it in the proper, with due respect and protocol. We don't want to, it's not proper just to act in a very disrespectful way without protocol, even when someone's done something. So persons who know how to deal, with superior persons will take everything into consideration and deal with that. So it's not wrong, but they may have, jumped above their position in the way they dealt with a superior person.
But a superior person has to act like a superior.
I'm not doubting that. But still, superior persons, so for instance, if say in a family, say the mother or the father, one of them has misbehaved in some way. So then the relatives who are appropriate have to deal with that. Who can, it's not up to the children to start calling the mother names. Oh, you prostitute, or the father, you whoremonger. It's not up to the children. They may be correct, but it's disrespectful. And over the course of the lifetime, they're still going to have to deal with those parents as parents. So they're overstepping their situation. It's not helpful, but the same authorities who may then as persons who deal with the persons who have committed the abhorrent activity will deal with them, then there are also parents who deal with the people who are affected by seeing superiors do something wrong. They also actually have to be counselled and dealt with, in a proper way, and consoled, and feel that they're going to get, if there's something being done wrong that affects them directly, that there's some justice. So they also have to be dealt with by appropriate persons. So the whole manner is that appropriate persons deal with it. Otherwise, recently or a few months ago, the Prime Minister was going to a function, and one young schoolboy grabbed an egg and smacked it over the back of his head. So, he was to be charged by that. That's assault. It's assault of the Prime Minister. But both the Prime Minister and the authorities said, okay, don't do it again because it is a crime, but we're going to let it off because you're a student. So, according to their situation in the Vedic times, this was appropriate. And of course, we have to consider that, you know. What are the punishments in Vedic times? Maybe different now in Kali Yuga. And in other words, those sons of Kalanami would know well the danger of insulting a very elevated person. So there are many different considerations there. Now, yep.
In that connection, I remember one set of sons of Brahma will actually approach him properly, and then
they actually spoke to him in a very proper respect and etiquette, and that's why he repented. Yeah.
So we can't follow that in ISKCON as well. We can't go to the, even if we see and if we are approaching a superior, so right, we tell them what they're doing wrong, and I don't know how practical that is in ISKCON. We still go to the superiors of the superior, and then
I've been around for 40 years. It's not very practical in ISKCON. You tell some authorities, they're doing the wrong thing, you probably end up a very unpopular person, according to management. And that'll be the end of it. But if you have a good relationship with them, then, you know, you can give it a try. But fools rush in where angels fear to tread. It's folly. Prabhupada himself says it's folly to be wise in a fool's paradise. But you know, we see that with Prabhupada, who was the ultimate authority, you know, if people had doubts about what he was doing, you know, some people didn't agree with book distribution or this, they could actually approach Prabhupada and say, you know, is this right? We're getting so much disturbance, Prabhupada. Maybe we could do something else, you know. Is this the right policy? You know, Prabhupada would discuss with them. And there would always be a loving relationship like that. So, you know, he's a very good example of an authority. And, you know, I've come across the odd person like that, an authority, believe it or not. And, you know, but some you can't. The classic one, which I just don't do anymore, but if someone's sitting on the asana and they speak something which is actually not correct, you know, it's just definitely not correct. So I've gone up to them after class and I've said, you know, Maharaj, it actually says this here. Oh, no. I don't hear. That's the last. So you show them the book. So, you know, if you have that sort of there should be that sort of relationship with the authorities in ISKCON. You know, we're not, you know, our whole movement is based upon our loving interactions between Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis, and our authorities are also supposed to be Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis. Not that there's Vaishnavas and Vaishnavas, and then you've got the authorities. So there's loving transactions between Vaishnavas and Vaishnavas, and then you've got authorities, and that's where it ends. They're also supposed to be Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis, and there should be loving transactions. So in ISKCON, we really do want to, be able to come to the point and manage in the way that Prabhupada did. And Prabhupada said, that in his books it said, one should not demand respect, but one should command respect. And where you have authorities that they don't command respect and they're doing things wrong, but they demand it, that's where the problem is. And they're very hard to deal with. But those authorities who command respect, I remember the previous temple president, Balaram, he was one of those ones that I could always go to. If there was something very wrong, not necessarily with what he was doing, because I never found anything wrong with what he was doing, but things that were going on in the temple that he was managing that shouldn't be happening, he would always, he was like a big brother. He was just, you could tell him anything. Very, very nice. I had no fear to go up to him and just speak my mind on anything. It was good. So he was very good, Balaram.
But it's also interesting that Prahlad Maharaj spoke straight to his father. He didn't follow the command. He just told him, what you're doing is wrong.
He said to him, my dear best of the demons.
Not laughing, Daddy.
He didn't say, you terror of a father, you imposter of a ruler, you are the best of the Asuras. Very respectful. Proper etiquette. Aranyakasipu, good noise. That's right. But he spoke plainly, but he asked him the question, what have you learned? So many things. This is what I've learned. But he was respectful. So these sons of Marici, they've passed through, the first sons of Marici, and then they pass through a life as demon, and then a life as demons again. And as Prabhupada mentioned in his verse, Canto 10, 85-50, he says, Prabhupada doesn't say it, but the Bhaktivedanta purporters, whatever you call them, they say, as pointed out by Srila Prabhupada in his purports to chapter 2, text 5 and 8 of this canto, Marici's sons were condemned for their offence against Lord Brahma, and in addition, Hiranyakashipu once cursed them to be killed by their own father in the future life. This curse was fulfilled by Vasudeva's letting Kamsa murder them one by one. So Prabhupada confirms both of those curses in those two births as well. And in that, Vishwanath Chakravarti, the cause commentary on that, was that Krishna said, being freed from the curse of Hiranyakasipu, they will be killed by their father and brought back by me, Krishna, then they will go to the heavenly planets. That was their... they will go to the heavenly planets. But as we do see, As far as I understand, they were also liberated because they got to drink the milk of Mother Devaki, whom Krishna had actually drunk from before he was taken to the other side of Jamuna. And so they also... So we'll get to that anyway. So we'll get to 85, as we know that those sons were eventually brought back by Krishna to Devaki. So, and... what happened is that when later on in the pastimes, Krishna brought back those six sons in their baby forms to Devaki. Yeah. And drinking her breast milk, because they're in the form of babies, they then revived their original identities and went back to their heavenly planets. Now, it is mentioned that they went to the planets of the self, you know, self-realized saintly persons, because in Prabhupada says in Krishna book chapter 85, it says, as such, the babies who sucked the breast of Devaki, which had touched the body of Lord Krishna, immediately become self-realized persons. So, you know, they were, although they went back to the heavenly planets, they were liberated persons as a result. And just a little benediction here. In that chapter 85, Sudha Goswami says, the pastime enacted by Lord Murari, whose fame is eternal, totally destroys the sins of the universe and serves as a transcendental ornament for his devotees' ears. Anyone who carefully hears and narrates this pastime, as recounted by the venerable son of Vyasa, will be able to fix his mind in meditation on the Supreme Lord and attain to the all-auspicious kingdom of God. So even just hearing this pastime that we just heard there about these six sons and how they were brought back, we're all going back to Godhead. That's good. Straight after class.
Right here, right now.
Yep. Okay. So we're up to verse, coming back to chapter 1, verse 67. Kings greedy for sense gratification on this earth almost always kill their enemies indiscriminately. To satisfy their own whims, they may kill anyone, even their mothers, fathers, brothers or friends. I was watching a documentary about Lenin, you know, the so-called father of, you know, communism in Russia. When he got into power, he had thousands and thousands of, you know, those who were in the opposition, previous in the opposition, had them all murdered. You know. So he was, you know, like the leader. He became the leader of Russia for some time. They just murdered thousands and thousands. The men, the women, the children. Got rid of the whole family. Now, in the purport, Prabhupada says that Kamsa did not hesitate to kill his nephews and imprison his sister and father. For demons to do such things is not astonishing. Nonetheless, although Kamsa was a demon, he was aware that Lord Vishnu cannot be killed, and thus he attained salvation. Even partial understanding of the activities of Lord Vishnu makes one eligible for salvation. Kamsa knew a little about Krishna, that he could not be killed, and therefore he attained salvation, although he thought of Vishnu, Krishna, as an enemy. What then is to be said of one who knows Krishna perfectly from the descriptions of Shastra like Bhagavad Gita? It is therefore the duty of everyone to read Bhagavad Gita and understand Krishna perfectly, and this will make one's life successful. So as we're saying, the benediction from hearing this is that we go back to Godhead, and that may seem surprising, but just look at how Kamsa, with a little understanding, he attained liberation. So verse 68, in his previous birth, Kamsa had been a great demon named Kalanimi and being killed by Vishnu. Upon learning this information from Narada, Kamsa became envious of everyone connected to the Yadu dynasty. And in the purport, Prabhupada mentions that persons who are demons, enemies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, are called asuras. As stated in the Gita, the asuras, because of their enmity toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead, take birth after birth in asura families and therefore glide down to the darkest hellish regions. So, you know, for Kamsa to attain salvation was, you know, Krishna's presence and that little realization he was allowed to have was Krishna's great mercy. Otherwise, generally, demons just go down, down, down. So don't try to go back to Godhead by becoming Krishna's enemy, because if he doesn't kill you, you go to hell. Kamsa, the most powerful son of Ugrasena, even imprisoned his own father, the king of Yadu, Bhoja and Andaka dynasties, and personally ruled the states known as Shurasena. Yeah. So in the Garga Samhita, we got this information that becoming angry at his son because of this, Emperor Ugrasena, that's Kamsa's father, who was the lord of the Yadavas, attempted to stop Kamsa and protect Vasudeva by sending his soldiers. Seeing Ugrasena's soldiers, Kamsa's soldiers rose against them so that a great battle was fought in the midst of the assembly. Soon 10,000 men were killed. Kamsa then picked up his club and easily crushed his father's soldiers, their foreheads, legs, faces, shoulders and arms broken. Many soldiers vomited blood, fell unconscious and died. The assembly hall thus became red as streams of blood came from their wounds. Then, being exceedingly angry, Kamsa grabbed his father, dragged him from his throne, bound him with ropes and locked him in a prison cell. Thereafter, while sitting on the throne, Kamsa personally ruled the opulent kingdoms of the Madhus and Surasenas. It's a little bit background as to, you know, why they were imprisoned. And now, in chapter 2, we hear a little bit more about these six sons of Kalanimi again. And, you know, we'll just discuss a little bit about the significance of this pastimes. In Bhaktivinoda Thakur's book, Sri Krishna, what is it?
Samhita.
It's also got a Bhajanamrita, I think it is. He says that in order to develop the love of God in the mood of the Brajabasis, there are 18 obstacles within our heart. So we're going to hear about those, and they're represented by the killing of 18 principal demons, etc., or you know, different pastimes. So this is one of them. So we're going to hear what is that? What does it represent? You know, what is this killing of Kamsa and that? So we're going to discuss that a little bit as well. Sukadeva Goswami said, and of course, we were discussing also that at the end we're going to do a 10,000 word thesis. That could be a nice thesis there as well, you know, the 18 obstacles of, on the path of Prema Bhakti.
Where is it mentioned?
Srila Bhaktivinoda, the cause, Sri Krishna Samhita.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I saw it the other day. I thought it was Samhita, and then I saw it under Sri Krishna Bhajanamrita, so that confused me. So, but he lists them in that book. I think what it is that Sri Krishna Samhita, perhaps Sri Krishna Samhita has two sections. Perhaps that's it. Because in the first section, what he does a lot of nice preaching to describe things, and then gradually, I think after that, he describes this part. So I think it's a two-part book. Maybe
so
that's what it is.
Each demon that Krishna kills represents an obstacle?
Yeah, there are 18 pastimes in these Vrindavan pastimes, and they represent, you know, and mostly of killing of demons represents one of the obstacles in the heart, such as, you know, envy. And and here we'll discuss this one of
Kamsa. Kalia was envious.
Kalia, that's right. So, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Sukadeva Goswami said, under the protection of Magadharaj, Jarasandha, the powerful Kamsa began persecuting the kings of the Yadu dynasty. In this, he had the cooperation of demons like Pralamba, Bhaka, Chanura, Trinavata, Agasura, Mushtika, Arista, Trivida, Putana, Keshi, Dunuka, Banasura, Narakasura, and many other demoniac kings on the surface of the earth. Of course, many of these demons could, shape shift. What do they call it? Shape. Yeah, there's a word for it. There's a modern word for it usually that's in all the movies. You know. I think it's shape-shifting, is it?
Transform?
Yeah, no, I think it's shape-shifting. Yeah. You've got to ask someone who's 15, they'll tell you.
Yeah,
I think it's shape-shifting. And so we know them, you know, as a big duck and, you know, a big crane and so many things, but they change their shape. Otherwise, they were, you know, run-of-the-mill demons. Now, so Prabhupada, he mentions in his purport that the demons naturally appeared more powerful than the demigods, but ultimately, because of help received from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the demons were defeated and the demigods triumphant. And a very important point that in the Garga Samhita, if you want to look at it, you'll see the activities that Kamsa had in... He actually fought with many of these people who then became his allies, and he also fought with the demigods in his previous life. So the demigods were actually quite fierce. He was a very, very powerful person. And that's why even Brahma, Shiva went with Bhumi, to approach Vishnu, because the demigods, it was beyond them, the situation to deal with. And that proves the supremacy of Vishnu above that, literally, single-handedly, Vishnu, in his, you know, as Krishna, or Krishna as Vishnu, whichever we want to say, single-handedly, he destroyed the whole problem, whereas they couldn't do it individually or collectively. Therefore, there's no question that the demigods are equal to Vishnu. And so, text 3, persecuted by the demoniac kings, the Yadavas left their own kingdom and entered various others like those of the Kurus, Panchalas, Kekayas, Salvas, Vidarbhas, Nisadas, Vidayas, and Kosalas. So they're fleeing. The Yadus are fleeing because they're being harassed. Some of the relatives, however, began to follow Kamsa's principles and act in his service. After Kamsa, the son of Ugrasena, killed the six sons of Devaki, a plenary portion of Krishna entered her womb as her seventh child, arousing her pleasure and her lamentation. That plenary portion is celebrated by great sages as Ananta, who belongs to Krishna's second quadruple expansion. Now, as Prabhupada mentions in the Krishna book, that Krishna broke the solidarity of the Yadu kingdom as well as the Bhoja and Andaka, and he made his position the most solid within the vast tract of land known at that time as Bharat Varsh. And we see here also that in the purport, it says that some of the chief devotees, such as Akrura, stayed with Kamsa to satisfy him. They did this for various purposes. They all expected the Supreme Personality of Godhead to appear as the eighth child as soon as Devaki's other children were killed by Kamsa, and they were eagerly awaiting his appearance. By remaining in Kamsa's association, they would be able to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead take birth and display his childhood pastimes, and Akrura would later go to Vrindavan to bring Krishna and Balaram to Mathura. The six children killed by Kamsa had formerly been the sons of Marichi, but because of having been cursed by a brahmana, they were obliged to take birth as grandsons of Hiranyakasipu. Who was that brahmana? Who was the brahmana that the six sons of Marichi were cursed by? No. There were two curses. What? There's two curses? Yeah, curse by a brahmana.
No, what am I saying? Yeah, isn't
it? It wasn't a Brahma himself. They laughed at Brahma.
Yeah, but Hiranyakasipu.
No, he was. Yeah, he's not a Brahmana though. He's born. He was a Kshatriya.
Yeah.
But he's the best of the demons. Hiranyakasipu did the second curse. So he's cursed by a brahmana. So either Lord Brahma cursed them, or, you know, Marichi or someone in that elk. But that was the first. That was when they were cursed the first time. So that they took birth as grandsons of Hiranyakasipu. Kamsa had taken birth as Kalanimi, and now he was obliged to kill his own sons. This was a mystery. As soon as the sons of Devaki were killed, they would return to their original place. The devotees wanted to see this also. So, there, some of the relatives, however, began. So, as it described there, you know, some of them wanted to complain. You know, they complained to Kamsa about what he'd done. They didn't think it was proper. But some of them actually began to follow Kamsa, his principle, and act in his service, and others, of course, just wanted to see the pastimes of Krishna. Now, here we go. The Sri Krishna Bhajanamrita by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So I've got it here listed as Bhajanamrita. And it may be a section of Sri Krishna Samhita. Or it may be in a little booklet by itself as well. Because, now, see, Prabhupada mentions in Krishna book, chapter 2, he says, many friends and relatives of Kamsa approached him and requested him to discontinue these heinous activities, but all of them became worshippers of Kamsa. Now, I'll read you from the, this is the essence of this pastime, including, what does Kamsa represent? What does baby Krishna represent? What does Vasudeva represent? What does Devaki represent? And what do the six sons of Kamsa represent? So we're going to discuss this. Now, I'll just, before I discuss that, I'm going to discuss a little bit just further background information on before I discuss that Sri Krishna Bhajanamrita. This is from the Garga Samhita. It's a little bit about Kalanimi. At that time of churning the milk ocean, a great demon named Kalanimi fought with Lord Vishnu and was violently killed by him. When Sukracharya revived Kalanimi by means of Sanjivini, the demon yearned to fight with Lord Vishnu again. On Mount Mandara, he performed severe austerities, drinking durva grass juice and worshipping Lord Brahma. When 100 celestial years had passed, all that remained of Kalanimi was his bones inside an anthill. Brahma then appeared and said to him, "Ask for a benediction," and so Kalanimi replied, "May my death not come from the hands of any of the demigods who have Lord Vishnu as their root." Brahma said, "O demon, the benediction request is difficult to attain, still I will grant it." From the womb of Ugrasena's wife, Kalanimi attained another demoniac birth. So that's a little bit about how he took that birth. Because he particularly took that birth so he could try and, you know, he wanted to fight with the Lord again. Okay. Sri Krishna Bhajanamrita. We understand the following purports from the pastimes of Krishna and Balaram's appearance. Kamsa personifies atheism, which always tries to curtail the absolute truth, Sri Krishna. So Krishna represents the absolute truth, and he does a very good portrayal because he is the absolute truth. Vasudev represents pure goodness. That's Vasudha Sattva, the spiritual platform. The platform of the appearance of the absolute truth. So when a devotee comes to the purely transcendental platform of Vasudha Sattva, the Lord becomes fully manifest, the glories of his name, fame, form, pastime within their heart and consciousness. And that is represented by Vasudev. Devaki personifies the heart filled with pure knowledge. And of course, that when one's comes to the platform of this pure spiritual platform, then within one's heart, the absolute truth will appear within the heart of that very loving devotee. The absolute truth manifests as represented by Devaki. And Balaram represents the supreme servitor of the Lord and embodies all living entities. Due to fear of Kamsa, he went to his home in Braja and entered the devoted heart of Rohini with the desire to kill atheism personified by Kamsa. Krishna was also transferred to Braja, to the home of Yashoda, the form of spiritual joyfulness. So, you know, the hearts of Devaki and Rohini represent the devoted heart of the bhaktas, and the absolute truth, Krishna, comes to personify atheism and tries to curtail the absolute truth, remove it, make it disappear, cover it. And therefore, you know, Krishna was imprisoned along with Devaki. Other people had to flee, such as Rohini. Balaram, the supreme servitor of the Lord, represents the spiritual master who serves the Lord by making arrangements to manifest the glories of the absolute truth. That is the Balaram is Prakash Tattva. So the demons are trying to curtail the absolute truth, and the devotees, headed by the spiritual master who represents Balaram, want to manifest the absolute truth, you know, and make that manifest to all living entities. So, now, when it says due to fear of Kamsa that Balaram went to his home in Braja and entered the devoted heart of Rohini, we understand that that's the fear of of Devaki, not the fear of Balaram. So, right, so they're the things. Kamsa represents, personifies atheism. Atheism means that influence always trying to curtail the absolute truth. Cover it, remove it, like that. That's it. I was speaking in class. That can include Hinduism. You know, actually, as we described here, I mentioned this in my Bhagavatam class last time. Is there someone here? Did someone give class called Ganga yesterday? Is there a...
Yeah.
There's a Ganga, because I wasn't sure whether to turn up, because I know they've got me in as Gangeshwar. There's a Ganga, is it?
Yes, there's a devotee. He's visiting from Mayapur.
Right. Yeah. I meant to call just to check, but yeah. Anyway, so last time Gangeshwar gave class, I was mentioning this, that as we see in these scriptures, whenever you read about Vishnu, he's always... spoken of throughout all the Vedas, different stories, as, worshipped by all the demigods. And yet somehow they derive this philosophy that, he is, manifestation of the absolute truth. In other words, he is not the relative truth that such as part of the material creation, which is relative truth. He is the source of, you know, all the different energies. Everything is relative to the absolute truth. So one who tries to cover that with some philosophy, including Hinduism, that is the Kamsa mentality. And the Vedas themselves say that one who equates the demigods as being equal to or greater than the Lord are called Pasandi, which means they're an atheist. It's atheism. Now, I was in class one time, someone asked me, are we aligned with Hindus or are we not? And from what I've seen from Prabhupada's, that was interesting, what I've seen from Prabhupada's, his statements, that when people asked him about, you know, our association, if they accepted the teachings of the Gita, yes, we're aligned with the Hindus. And whenever they weren't to accept the tenets of the Gita, no, we're not aligned with that. And that, so, you know, so many times he would say, yes, you know, the Hindus, yeah, because they were in where he was speaking, they were aligned with the Gita. And as soon as they don't line up with it, then no, we're not aligned with the Hindus. So if they start, you know, preaching this, you know, the demigods are equal to Vishnu and that, that's atheism. And we're not aligned to that sort of Hinduism. But we are aligned to any Hindu who follows the Bhagavad Gita properly. No, they have to follow that Vishnu is the source of all the demigods, which is what it says in the Gita. If they follow it, that's right. Bhagavad Gita as it is. Impersonal... Well, there is no impersonal Bhagavad Gita. There's only personal Bhagavad Gita. So they may call it Bhagavad Gita, but that's their own nonsense. Yeah. We have seven senses. What is it? What are the seven senses, Srimurti? Five senses, the mind and?
Intelligence.
The iPhone. Okay. Hey? Yeah, I've got eight. I've got two phones. Okay. Now, and the Satgarbhas, they also fit into this, some very interesting purports here. And of course, we mentioned there in verses 4 or 5 that Balaram appeared, and Nanta, Sankishan, as Prabhupada mentions in his purport, belongs to the second chapter of Vyuha, or quadruple expansion. And this is the opinion of experienced commentators. And why is that? Why are we referring to Balaram as Sankishan and not the original Balaram? Why are we doing that?
Because Balaram is the first expansion from Krishna, and then from him comes the Chaturvyuha.
Yeah.
And then after that, the expansion that comes is for Sankarshanism.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So Balaram, because Balaram, because here, Krishna and Balaram, when they appear in Mathura, but actually Krishna and Balaram never leave Vrindavan. So these are the expansion of Vasudeva Krishna and Sankarshan Balaram from the second quadruple. So they're expansions. But when they enter the when they actually appear in their full manifestation as the original Krishna and the original Balaram, that is their forms in Vrindavan. So we understand that we're talking about. So we shouldn't misunderstand this, that Balaram is not the full, you know, because it says here that, you know, the second quadruple, we should understand Balaram is the full manifestation of the Lord, the first expansion of the Lord, and Krishna is first. But first they appeared in their expansion forms, because Krishna, whenever he apparently leaves Vrindavan, he is in his expansion forms. So, and therefore, you know, he's called Ananta, and a part of Krishna. And, right, now, very important here, we see that in the Krishna book, that Devaki was overwhelmed with both jubilation and lamentation. She was joyful, for she could understand that Lord Vishnu had taken shelter within her womb, but at the same time she was sorry that as soon as her child would come out, Kamsa would kill him. And from the Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 2, Verse 6, to protect the Yadus, his personal devotees, from Kamsa's attack, the personality of Godhead Vishvatma, the supreme soul of everyone, ordered Yogamaya as follows. Prabhupada mentions in the purport by Sanatana Goswami, this commentation, Bhagavan Svayam is Krishna. He is Vishvatma, the original supersoul of everyone, but his plenary portion expands as the supersoul. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 13.3. Also bear in mind that when Krishna appears, even in his plenary expansion, and Balaram is appearing in their plenary expansion in Mathura, we also understand that Krishna and Balaram have appeared, because there is no difference between Krishna and his expansion. And we read previously that just as Nitya Siddhas, in the commentaries of Vishwamaptakrabhati the Gaur, just as the Nitya Siddhas appear, their expansions appear within the bodies of the demigods, and therefore their confidential nature of their spiritual identity is kept confidential, because it's not able to be understood by everyone. Vishwanath Chakravarti, the course, says that the Lord, he appears, but he may also appear in a confidential way as his expansion. But we understand that that is Krishna fully, because Krishna is appearing, and he's, you know, fully manifest, although he has appeared in a confidential way in his expansion. So we understand that's Krishna and Balaram, and at the same time we understand that he's appeared in an expansion.
Krishna has got 64 qualities, all the Balaram also.
He didn't show them all, that's all, at that stage. So when it says he appears in an expansion, it means he's not going to show all his full manifestation, but it doesn't mean he's the same person. Now, okay, and so as you know, even here it says in the purport. So originally, Prabhupada said, Bhagavan Svayam is Krishna. He is Vishvatma. Krishna is Vishvatma, the original super soul of everyone. because his plenary portion expands as a super soul. And then we're hearing that this Krishna is actually Vishvatma by his plenary expansion as Vishnu Tattva. Yet because of his affection for his devotee, he acts as super soul to give them directions. So we're taking it as Krishna, by the way.
Brahma, I think once you mentioned that when Krishna goes out of Vrindavan, then he's the expanded form, not the original Krishna.
Yes.
But isn't in the spiritual world, isn't Dwaraka above? Dwaraka is still above the
Vaikuntha
planet.
Yes. In Krishna's planet, Krishna Loka, there are three divisions. Vrindavan, where the devotees enjoy prema bhakti without any sense of the Lord's majesty. That's firstly. Thirdly, there's Dwarka, where the devotees enjoy love of God with a sense they worship, they love Krishna, not Narayan, but Krishna, but they have a sense of his majesty. And Mathura is in the middle, a little mixture of the majesty of the Lord and the sweetness of Vrindavan. It's a little mixture. But they're all on Krishna Loka. They're the divisions, different divisions of the same Krishna Loka. So this Kshiradakshai Vishnu is also there within Krishna in Vrindavan. And whenever he kills the demons in Vrindavan or out of Vrindavan, he's doing so in his Vishnu feature, because that is the business of the super soul Vishnu to do that. Now, here we see, now we've spoken about Yoga Maya and Maha Maya, and just very briefly again, in the purport, Yoga Maya is the spiritual potency of the Lord. Out of affection for his devotees, the Lord always stays in touch with them. Although otherwise, his Maya potency is so strong that she bewilders even exalted demigods like Brahma. Therefore, the Lord's potency is called Yoga Maya, right? Keeping the devotees in touch, a connection. And since the Lord is Vishvatma, he immediately ordered Yoga Maya to give protection to Devaki. And Prabhupada mentions in the Krishna book that Krishna is the Lord of the universe, but he is especially the Lord of the Yadu dynasty. I like that. And just a very quick summary. We know that Yogamaya, acting spiritually with the devotees and the Lord, appeared as Subhadra, Krishna's sister. When Yoga Maya, the little girl born to Yashoda, the twin sister of Krishna, was transferred to Dwarka, Mathura, Yoga Maya stayed in Vrindavan, and only the Mahamaya expansion went back to Mathura as Durga. And it's understood that Yogamaya in Vrindavan is Purnamasi, and Yogamaya in Dwarka is Subhadra. Oh, probably. Look. Yeah. And if you want to, you see in, Shivaram's Naparayaham, where he's summarizing the Acharya's writings, our Acharya's, he says, every aspect of Krishna's pastime is under the direction of Yoga Maya. The divine fate is an aspect of his internal potency and is known as Yoga Maya. In Vrindavan, Yoga Maya is personified in the form of Purnamasi, the grandmother of Madhu Mangala. And in Dwarka, she appears as Subhadra Devi, Krishna's sister. In Braja, Yoga Maya's power of attorney reaches its summit. To facilitate Krishna's complete absorption in pastimes, she even makes him, Krishna, forget his godhood. And that is quoted from the Rupa Goswami's Radha Ganadesha Dipika. So the ultimate authority there about Subhadra in Dwarka being Yoga Maya is coming from Rupa Goswami. And in the Sri Gaura Ganadesha Dipika, as you all know, is written by Kavikarna Purna. Purnamasi is described as appearing as Srila Govinda Acharya, the expert author of songs and poetry during Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. But you all knew that. Okay. Now, here's a letter from Prabhupada. Subhadra, this is from his writing to one of his disciples. Subhadra is Yoga Maya. The spiritual energy is called Yoga Maya, and she has 16 different expansions. Out of these 16 expansions, Subhadra is one. The Mahamaya of the material energy is also expansion of the energy of Yoga Maya, and both Yoga Maya and Mahamaya are equally important to Krishna as much as any government department is equally important for functioning of the government. The police department may be horrible for the criminals, but to the government, it is a department as good as university department. Similarly, Mahamaya is horrible to the conditioned souls, but to be liberated, there is no fear of Mahamaya because he is protected by Yoga Maya. It is stated in the Bhagavad Gita when Krishna said the following, I am not visible to everyone on account of being curtailed by Yoga Maya. So when a conditioned soul surrenders unto Krishna, the Yoga Maya winds up the curtain and Krishna is visible to the devotee. I like that, isn't it? Yoga Maya winds up the curtain. There he is. A little addition. Prabhupada's made a little addition to the Bhagavad Gita. Well, that's what Srimad Bhagavatam is. So, that was a letter by Prabhupada, a letter to Madhusudan in Montreal, 29th of July, 1968.
What was that book by Rupa Goswami?
That was basically Shivaram Swami in his Naparayaham is quoting the Radha Ganadesha Dipika by Rupa Goswami, verses 67-69. We get 2 minutes. Okay. Right. Very quickly, I'll just summarise how the six sadgarbhas fit in with this analogy of the absolute truth being covered by the demons, right? To do that, I'm going to just read this verse 7. The Lord ordered Yoga Maya, O my potency, who are worshipable for the entire world and whose nature is to bestow good fortune upon all living entities, go to Braja, where there are many cowherd men and their wives in that very beautiful land where many cows reside. Rohini, the wife of Vasudev, is living at the home of Nanda Maharaj. Other wives of Vasudev are also living there incognito because of fear of Kamsa. Please go there. I'll come back to that point next week. But very quickly, Vishwanath Chakravarti at the core says, after Devaki's six children were killed, Vasudev, seeing Rohini pregnant, sent her secretly to Nanda Gokul. Nanda Gokul. Aha. Uh-huh. That's why Vishwanath Chakravarti, the cause is. After Devaki's six children were killed, Vasudeva seeing Rohini pregnant, sent her secretly to Nanda Gokul.
But then actually again...
Because this happened over 8 years. You know, this would be the seventh year. Huh? So over a long period of time.
Yeah, but then actually if there were in the prison...
They have conjugal visits. So, but as we know, Krishna and Balaram did not appear by seminal process. But they were still transferred by heart to heart. Yeah. So they were in association. And then he sent her after seeing her pregnant. Now, here's this verse. This is what you need to know. I'm going to come back to... Within the womb of Devaki is my partial plenary expansion known as Sankarshan or Sesha. Without difficulty, transfer him into the womb of Rohini. I'll discuss that more next week, but I want to discuss this point here. Prabhupada mentions in the purport to that verse, number 8, a pure devotee is always transcendentally situated because of executing 9 different processes of bhakti yoga, shravanam, kirtanam, etc. Thus situated in devotional service, a devotee, although in the material world, is not in the material world. Yet, a devotee always fears, quote, because I am associated with the material world, so many contaminations affect me. Therefore, he is always alert in fear, which gradually diminishes his material association. Symbolically, Mother Devaki's constant fear of Kamsa was purifying her. No one home. A pure devotee should always fear material association. So he's talking about pure devotees. They can be gurus, sannyasis, leaders, temple presidents, regional secretaries, GBCs. Right? They should always fear material association, and in this way, brahmacharis, grihasthas. Right? In this way, all the assurers of material association will be killed as the sadgarbhas were killed by Kamsa. So, the sadgarbhas were originally asuras, and by the fear of Devaki, they represent... Devaki's fear represents this fear of material association, and when that happens, the sadgarbhas representing, we'll tell you what they represent, disappear. They represent material principles. It is said that from the mind, Marichi appears. In other words, Marichi is an incarnation of the mind. Marichi has 6 sons, symbolically. Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada and Matsara, or lust, anger, greed, illusion, madness and envy. The Supreme Personality of Godhead appears in pure devotional service. Only bhakti can bring one in contact with the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord appeared from the womb of Devaki, and therefore Devaki symbolically represents bhakti. And Kamsa symbolically represents material fear. When a pure devotee always fears material association, his real position of bhakti is manifest and he naturally becomes uninterested in material enjoyment. When the 6 sons of Marichi are killed by fear and one is free from material contamination, within the womb of bhakti, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears. See? And again, in the purport, Prabhupada mentions, thus, the 7th pregnancy of Devaki signifies the appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. after the six sons, Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madha, Matsya, are killed, the Sesha incarnation creates a suitable situation for the appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In other words, when one awakens his natural Krishna consciousness, Lord Krishna appears. This is the explanation given by Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravarti Thakura. So, we have Kamsa representing atheism and an atheistic association, and therefore devotees fear that atheistic association. When devotees have that proper respect for the material energy and material associations, then their bhakti becomes very strong, it grows properly, it fully matures. And when their bhakti matures fully, then Balaram appears, of course, representing the teachings of the Guru, which allows the personality of Godhead to manifest within one's heart. And so meditate upon that. We'll hear a little bit more about that section. We'll come back to those same points. And if you have any doubts or questions or comments, we'll pick up from there. We'll refresh ourselves on that next week, and then we'll move into how the demigods, of course, came and offered some beautiful prayers to Mother Devaki. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama.